cast of characters. So yesterday we reviewed what the basic components of the standard model are. I'm going to do a very lightning review of what we saw yesterday and finish up the things that weren't said. So standard model, we have QCD, which is the SU3 color portion of the story. It has 8 gluons, 6 quarks, times 3 colors for each quark. We have the uptype, the charm, and the top. These are the uptypes. We have down the strange and the bottom. And the gluons have interactions, always denoted by springs. So these are the gluons. And they interact with quarks in ways that never change quark flavor. They couple the quarks equally in, to their right-handed and to their left-handed parts. And there's so there's no flavor physics, no flavor changing. Preserves CP and parity. So by preserving parity, it couples to left and right-handed parts the same way. We'll talk more about CP later. But this is like QED, only more so. For the electroweak sector, this is the SU2 left cross U1 hypercharge part of the gauge group. The L is just to remind you that the gauge bosons that we'll call X sub A from SU2 and B for a hypercharge, the X gauge bosons only couple the left-handed parts of Dirac spinners. And this features the W, the Z, and the photon after electroweak symmetry breaking. So that's when the Higgs boson gets its VEV, and this transitions to U1 electromagnetism, where we identify the photon as a linear combination of some of these gauge bosons. We saw that the W will always couple an up type to a down type quark. So it's got charge plus minus, so whatever it's coupling to has to have a charge difference. And for the Z, the Z will couple to any kind of quark, but at tree level, it preserves flavor. So for the W, there's flavor changing, no flavor changing tree level. Of course, at loop level, some of these statements are going to change. As part of the electroweak sector, we also have leptons. So these are spin 1/2 particles that don't feel the strong force. We saw that those were the electron, the muon, and the tau, and their corresponding neutrinos, nu e, nu mu, nu tau. And of course, the neutrinos are massless in the standard model. The masses for these we saw yesterday. And the W always couples a charged lepton to its corresponding neutrino. The Z couples a lepton to its antiparticle. And the lepton in this case can be either a quark or either a charged lepton or a neutrino. The Z is the only gauge boson in the standard model that couples to two neutrinos. There are also interactions among the gauge bosons. So just like gluons, we have quartic and cubic vertices where gauge bosons talk to each other. And these come out of the kinetic terms in a non-abelian gauge theory. After electroweak symmetry breaking, which we'll learn about in gory detail, we'll see that after the Higgs settles into its vacuum expectation value, there'll be vertices that couple to two W bosons to two Zs. order two photons. There's also going to be a mixed diagram where there's WW gamma Z, and there are diagrams where you can have a gamma or a Z, and it's just a trilinear W plus, W minus plus. Okay? So electroweak interactions break parity. They didn't have to do anything special in order to break parity. It's just that the theory was built by treating left-handed and right-handed fermions differently. And the main point of today's lecture will be to build up the formalism to talk about two-component spinners in a way that makes the rest of the standard model seem intuitive. So left-handed, not the same as right-handed. And it can also, doesn't always, but it can, violate CP, which is important because you can't generate a matter-antimatter asymmetry in the early universe unless CP is violated, among other things. Of course, the standard model all by itself doesn't have enough of it in order to actually give rise to an appreciable difference between matter and antimatter. And of course, after it's all said and done, there's also QED, which you're already familiar with. The photon is really part of this whole sector, but QED all by itself, after you break electroweak symmetry, it separates off. Its left-handed couplings are the same as its right-handed couplings, and you've already seen this story, so I'm not going to belabor the point. The one thing we haven't seen, though, is the Higgs. So 2012, it was discovered at the LHC. The mass of the Higgs is 125 GeV. And it's the only scalar particle. Well, the only fundamental scalar particle, or elementary scalar particle, in the standard model. You can make other kinds of scalar particles by building composite states out of quarks after QCD confines at lower energies. But the Higgs is the only one that starts life as a scalar, and we'll denote it by the usual dashed line for a scalar particle. It couples to all the fermions, couples to particle and antiparticle, usual Yukawa interaction. And these diagrams are always proportional to the fermion mass divided by the VeV of the Higgs, where we'll recall that the expectation value of the Higgs, I should use my notation consistently. So this is defined to be V, which is approximately 246 GeV. This is known once you've specified the masses of the gauge bosons and you've measured their coupling constants. V is determined uniquely, and it enters into these couplings in a way that's proportional to mass. So the Higgs couples more strongly to things that have big mass. It couples very strongly to the top quark, not so strongly to some of the other quarks. I should just mention here, F in these diagrams is not the neutrino. Oh, crap. My V looks like a nu. I'm just going to say that's a neutrino. So it doesn't couple to neutrinos. Not for any special reason. It's just that there are no right-handed neutrinos. Neutrinos in the standard model. And that'll become important because the Higgs secretly likes to talk to the left-handed and to the right-handed parts in a pairwise fashion. So if you don't have a right-handed fermion in your theory, then the Higgs can't talk to it. And it also gives mass to gauge bosons. We'll see how that works. So I can talk fast and loose about this stuff right now. It'll couple, and that this will be proportional to the masses of the W and to the Z. So once you replace the Higgs with its vacuum expectation value, these will look a lot like mass terms for the gauge bosons and for the fermions. And there are also interactions involving the Higgs and gauge bosons, where I can write down WZ, and H is neutral. neutral under QED, it carries no electrical charge. Okay. And so that's it. That's the whole standard model. And I'd like to devote the rest of this lecture to machinery. Because the standard model is fundamentally a chiral theory, and we're going to have to deal with things like spontaneous symmetry breaking, and so I just want us to all be on the same page. Some of this is going to be review, most of it just to establish notation. And where we're going... So today, I want to talk about two components... spinners, the Lorentz group. So first I'll just remind you a little bit about what the Lorentz group's all about, how it acts on familiar objects like four vectors. It'll be a lightning review. You've already seen this. I just want to connect it to the, what we'll actually be talking about. Then I want to talk about the differences between Majorana and Dirac masses. And two versus four component spinners. I don't think I'll have time for this, but if I'm feeling ambitious, which I'm not, I'll also talk about the Goldstone theorem. Okay. So for the Lorentz group, if I have a four vector X, and I want to perform a Lorentz transformation, X mu goes to X prime mu. I'm going to act on it with a matrix, X nu. And that matrix preserves certain properties. We demand that X mu is the same as X prime mu. And in order for that to work, there's a simple criterion that the metric has to transform in a certain way. So that if I'm contracting these with the G mu nu tensor, once I perform the transformation on the x's to make them x primes, if G mu nu transforms in the following way, then this remains invariant. So this is familiar to everybody. And the point is, and I'm just going to be totally obvious about it, that G mu nu is an invariant symbol. It's an invariant symbol, and it contracts vectors to produce scalars. Okay, but it only works on four vectors. And there's a formal way of talking about the transformations themselves. So transformations every Lorentz transformation can be thought of as a combination of a boost and a rotation. So I'm going to define a theta vector to be some angular rotation about some axis. So this is going to be axis of rotation. And I'll define xi. Is that xi? I think so. That's xi, right? Okay, good. I'm going to define this to be v hat tangent inverse of v. So this is the boost param. And I can think of any generic transform, lambda in the following way. So I can say lambda mu nu is defined to be exponential of minus I over 2 omega alpha beta j alpha beta mu nu. So it's a matrix. But inside the exponential, we've also got matrices, and these are the indices of it after you've expanded everything out in gory detail. So here, choice of transformation parameters, generators, and here the alpha and beta. Alpha, beta, label the matrix. So each choice of alpha and beta picks out a different matrix. And then that matrix's own indices are going to be mu and nu after you've expanded everything and added it together. And we can identify, define W alpha beta, or in the following way, I'm going to relate W alpha beta to the boost and rotation parameters. So I can define theta I to be 1 half epsilon ijk wjk. But I'm not kidding. So theta I is just something that we choose. And once I choose it, I can uniquely define omega, where I'm working in the convention where epsilon is the Levi-Civita tensor, and that 1, 2, 3 is plus 1. And an anti-symmetric permutation gives you a minus. And I can also define the components of the boost vector as the 0, 1 component of this. So I'm obviously not going to derive any of this. I assume you've seen it in quantum field theory or in some other context. I just want to lay it out there because it's going to work and it's going to be useful for us for building up spinners. So these are the things we choose. Okay. For the generators, so these are actually part of the Lorentz group. They have a certain prescribed commutation relation. The generators I can define in the following way. So Ji is going to be 1 half epsilon ijk jjk, and so apologies for the notation, but I'll connect this to this form of the transformation to make it more obvious in just a moment. And I'll define ki to be j0i equals minus ji0. So I've actually defined new vectors J and K. They're defined in terms of the generators of the Lorentz group. And I can think of lambda, my generic Lorentz transformation, as the exponential now of minus I, my theta vector dotted into my J vector. Suggestively, this is going to be the generator of rotations. And there's going to be a generator of boosts as well, which I'll define to be k. The components of k are given by this relationship. Components of j are given by that one. This is actually what defines this tensor. And the tensor commutation relations for j mu nu. And this is going to be true for any representation of the Lorentz group. We're going to have that J mu nu J alpha, I'm going to do rho sigma, sorry, is I G mu nu J rho sigma minus the same thing where I'm interchanging mu and nu, and then minus the same thing outside the bracket where I'm interchanging rho and sigma. Yeah. Okay, and that's true for any representation of the Lorentz group. So the J's will differ depending on what we're transforming, what we're acting on. So the simplest thing that we can act on is a four vector. And so we know how four vectors transform under the Lorentz group. And so for four vectors, I can define J rho sigma. Here, rho sigma instead of alpha beta just labels the names of each of the matrices. And mu and nu are that matrix, the indices of that matrix. And I can define this to be G rho mu G sigma nu minus G sigma mu G rho nu. Okay. So, oh, yeah. Well, okay, so first you should always check me on signs and indices. I think it's okay. So if I interchange rho and sigma here, right? But here I'm not changing mu and nu, I'm just changing rho and sigma.
Sure, but the first thing just doesn't
contribute. That's right. Okay, you're right. Okay, so I've probably screwed up my indices. Well, actually, let me check. I've written it out maybe over here somewhere. Okay, well, you should check me on the permutation of the indices. I'll put it up on the website. I'll put an asterisk just to remind us to check this. I may have put it wrong in my notes, but it might be a permutation of these, but it'll have that form. The point is that you have two of the commutators, and this contains all the structure about how they're connected to each other. The right-hand side is just going to be linear in these. So, okay, you can check this in the Srednicki textbook. And it's free online. So you can go to Mark Srednicki's website, and he's got it for free, and there's a good section on this. Okay. So up to that ambiguity, I know it has that form, so you should check exactly what the index structure is. But the point is that that's everything we need to know for four vectors. So once you choose this or the relevant permutation of Lorentz indices, you have a form for the J's. It looks something like this. And then you can build up a completely generic Lorentz transformation in the following way, because the components of these tensors will give us what we need for the boost and for the rotation generators, so that whenever you specify what a theta and a xi is, you can perform any Lorentz transformation on any four vectors. So now what about other reps? What about spinners in particular? Okay. So we're acting on something that's operator valued. So if I want to define something that I'll call psi alpha of x, so this is an operator, but it carries some sort of space-time dependence. If I want to transform an operator under a Lorentz transformation, I act on it with some unitary operator u of lambda inverse psi alpha of x and u of lambda. And I want to know what that is in terms of something that we can relate to the Lorentz generators. So I'm going to define m alpha beta of lambda acting on psi of beta, lambda inverse of x. Okay. So in principle, this ansatz works for any sort of quantum field, regardless of what kinds of indices we have. This is the kind of relationship that we're always going to want to have for Lorentz transformations. And the question is, what's the form of M? So so we can define M of lambda is, so it's going to look very similar to the usual case for four vectors. Alpha, beta. But now the J's are different. It's a different representation. But they'll have the same commutation relations. And just pulling this out of a hat, I'm gonna declare without proof that the rotation generator acting on a two-component object that has all the commutation properties of the Lorentz group is going to look like this. And the boost operator is going to look like this, where I'm going to define the vector sigma as sigma 1, sigma 2, sigma 3. And I'm probably getting into territory where it's hard for people to see. And these are just the Pauli matrices. So sigma 1 is 0, 1, 1. Sigma 2 is 0, and sigma 3 is 1, 0, 0, minus 1. It's minus I? Okay, good. It's on the top. All right, good. Good, thank you. Yes, there should. Okay, good. So we call this representation the left-handed representation. In the literature, you'll see things like this. So it's the 1 half comma 0 representation that's got one kind of spinner of left-handed type and zero kinds of spinners of right-handed type. But of course, we can also build a conjugate representation. By defining J right-handed to be sigma star over 2 and K right-handed to be minus star over 2. And that's a totally fine representation. It's distinct from the one that we've just written down, but it's very similar in spirit. And a right-handed representation, acts on spinners that have indices with dots on them. In fact, I'll call this I'm just putting this up here because it's pretty standard in the literature to talk about two-component spinners in the right-handed representation as having a dotted index. You see it in supersymmetry, you see it in string theory, it happens a lot. So for now, and when we talk about the standard model, we're gonna concentrate on left-handed spinners because we can always build a left-handed spinner out of a right-handed spinner and vice versa just by conjugation because these generators are simply related. I forgot the I again. Because if I have a left-handed spinner psi alpha, I can just do the usual Hermitian conjugation, and that's going to give me, by definition, something that will transform as psi dagger alpha dot. These are different representations. And now the question is how to build invariants. Invariants in the sense that for four vectors, we take two four vectors, they have vector indices, and we contract them with G mu nu, and that gives us a scalar, and that scalar product is invariant in all frames. The question is, what's the analog of that? In this case, we're transforming things that have these funny two-component, they have these indices with dots and without dots. The dot doesn't mean anything special, by the way, for the right-handed representation. It's just to remind you that it's in the right-handed representation. And we want to know how to take objects that are either two-component in the left-handed or in the right-handed representation and build invariants out of those. So note that when we did it for four vectors, we asked, well, okay, so here I have x or phi nu, and I wanted to build an invariant object out of that. So I said g mu nu times x mu phi nu is invariant because g mu nu transforms as lambda mu beta nu g alpha beta. So if we can find something that transforms similarly, then we'll know how to contract spinorial indices too to construct an invariant. So now we can recall that if you combine two spin objects, two spin one-half objects, you can get a singlet and a triplet, and that the singlet configuration is antisymmetric. So if I have psi alpha, psi beta, I'm just going to define that to be C alpha beta for convenience. I can say that C alpha beta is going to have the following structure. So I can write down an antisymmetric part that goes as the Levi-Civita tensor times some scalar function d of x, and it's totally arbitrary. This just transforms as a Lorentz scalar, but this is now operator valued. So these are all operators. And there's going to be something else, which I don't care about. So this is going to be symmetric. Okay. And so the question is, what can we learn about contracting two-component objects with this decomposition? So if we act on the anti-symmetric part alone, something interesting will happen. So now we're just going to transform in the operator sense the part that goes like epsilon alpha beta times d of x times u of lambda. And as always, we demand that this thing transform in a way that's appropriate to spinorial indices. So they're going to be some matrices M, and these are going to be the same matrices that we had acting on the spinners. I forget where I put them. It's in the upper right-handed corner there. So now we're going to have two matrices because we have two of these indices of lambda. sorry, that's not a beta. Let's call this lambda kappa. There are too many indices to keep track of. I'm just going to remind you that these are spinner indices. So where alpha beta can equal 1 or 2. Beta of lambda acting on epsilon lambda kappa and d of lambda inverse of x. So now I'm just transforming the scalar part in the way that we're used to seeing scalar fields transform under Lorentz transformations. And this is not an operator. Epsilon alpha beta is just the Levi-Civita tensor, so I can take the left-handed side of this and I can write it as epsilon alpha beta U1 inverse of lambda acting on d of x, which is a Lorentz scalar, U of lambda, and that's going to be alpha lambda m beta kappa of lambda times epsilon lambda kappa times d of lambda inverse x. Okay? So I've been able to take this outside because it's not an operator. And this is actually just the definition of d of lambda inverse x, because that's how scalars transform. And so the conclusion is that really epsilon by itself transforms as m alpha m beta kappa lambda epsilon kappa lambda, just like g mu nu. Which means we can take it seriously as something that raises and lowers spinorial indices. And it contracts spinners, makes them scalars. Okay? So this is what we need. So now, for the epsilon alpha beta that's appropriate to the left-handed spinner representation, psi alpha psi beta times epsilon alpha beta is going to be defined to be psi alpha in the usual way. But now we recall that epsilon 1, 2 is defined as plus 1. And the other permutation is going to have a minus sign. I'm running out of board room. Okay. Okay, so fermions anti-commute. So if I have epsilon alpha beta psi alpha psi beta, I should choose a different one. So these are both left-handed spinners. Then this is going to be minus epsilon alpha beta chi beta psi alpha, but it's also going to be plus epsilon beta alpha chi beta psi alpha. So this is going to be the same as chi alpha psi alpha. And so oftentimes you'll just see the fermion contraction suppressed. And so it's straightforward to say that psi alpha chi alpha equals chi alpha psi alpha, or just chi psi equals psi chi. Okay. So, all right, so we've got everything in place to talk about the simplest kind of quantum field theory that you can build out of spinners. I should just note before we move on that all the same arguments apply to the dotted representation. So for right-handed, epsilon, so epsilon is going to have an alpha, it's going to have dotted indices. It's going to be the same. There's a sign convention that varies widely across the literature, so that if you're epsilon alpha beta for the left-handed representation with the indices raised is the plus one, then the one for the right-handed representation will be the minus one. So just check to make sure that whatever convention you're using or following is consistent. And just by pure convention, this is the last thing I'll say about the formalism, that when you contract left-handed spinners, psi alpha, chi alpha, the indices go down as you move across the page. So in other words, a contraction involves an index raised going to one that's lowered. And for the right-handed representation, it's the opposite. So if I have psi chi dagger alpha dot, it's always going up like that. So what's the simplest two-component theory? So the simplest two-component theory is going to look like the following. So I'm going to write down a Lagrangian. And I'll make contact with what we've already seen in QED. So in QED, everything was done in terms of four-component spinners. There's a natural way to map on what we've learned about two-component spinners in the left-handed and the right-handed representations onto what we know about Dirac spinners. There's a very corresponding mapping. It's just that a Dirac spinner basically contains one left-handed and one right-handed spinner in exactly this way. But the language in the literature usually makes this kind of obscure. Maybe I've made it more obscure. Maybe I've made it less obscure. But this is standard. So we can write down a Lagrangian for one two-component spinner in the following way. I've just violated my own convention. Dot alpha, d mu, psi alpha. So here's the kinetic term. We're used to seeing kinetic terms with gamma matrices. Gamma matrices contain Pauli matrices because you recall that gamma mu in one representation, in the chiral representation, looks like this, where sigma mu is defined as the 2x2 identity and the vector of Pauli matrices. And the one with the bar on top is the same thing, but minus the vector part. And the only new thing that we're introducing about the notation for these matrices is that now, since these matrices will always contract a right-handed and a left-handed spinner to give us something that transforms as a Lorentz vector, so you would take this mu seriously as a Lorentz vector index, we have to put indices on this to remind us exactly how to contract them. So that if we write down sigma bar mu, the indices are on top and the dotted one is first. For sigma mu, the indices are going to be on the bottom, and they're going to be flipped. So it's bottom, and it's alpha dot on the right. And that's just to enforce this convention, because the way that the spinners will contract is always going to be down to up for the dotted one and up to down for the undotted one. So this is the simplest kinetic term we can write down. It's exactly the same kind of kinetic term you would get if you expanded out the usual QED Lagrangian, or just the Lagrangian for a Dirac spinner, and you decomposed it in terms of its left and right-handed pieces. This is just the part that would give you the left-handed piece. And we can write down a mass term, m over 2 psi alpha alpha plus the Hermitian conjugate, alpha dot psi dagger alpha dot. And so this is the simplest two-component theory, and we refer to the mass terms that involve the same two-component spinners. As Majorana. After Ettore Majorana, who died a very tragic death, so it's believed, but he disappeared and no one knows what happened to him. Well, actually, I can probably just delete that. Pardon? Oh, cool. Okay. So what's wrong? Well, nothing's really wrong. Everything's fine with the Lagrangian that we've written up there. The problem is we can't couple to spin one particle. And the logic is as follows. So if you wanted to couple it to, say, a U1, so U1 local. So if you wanted to add a U1 local symmetry, you might imagine that psi alpha would transform as e to the I cube psi. This is the charge under the U1 and some function of space-time indices times psi. And fair enough, you could do that. And you could promote the kinetic term so you would take d mu and you would replace it by the covariant derivative, which is going to be the usual derivative minus I the gauge coupling for the U1 times q psi times some gauge boson for the U1, and that's totally fine. You can do that, but now your Lagrangian looks like psi dagger alpha dot mu alpha dot alpha d mu psi alpha. So this part's totally fine, but the trouble is in the mass term. So now psi alpha plus the Hermitian conjugate. If we transform this piece, everything's okay after we transform, because a prime goes to A goes to A minus 1 over G del mu f of x. And so this shift in the gauge field will compensate for the fact that there's a derivative acting on the function that lives inside this exponent. We've all seen that. But the problem is here. So these have exactly the same gauge charges. And so mass term goes from psi alpha into e to the I times 2 cube psi f of x psi alpha, and so that's bad. So it's not gauge invariant. So I can't write down a mass involving a spin 1/2 two-component field that's coupled to a U1 gauge field. The mass term is not gauge invariant. How much time? Oh, we've got plenty of time. So how do we fix the problem? So we had a second field, chi, with a charge q chi that's equal to minus q psi. So that now the Lagrangian for psi and for chi is going to have kinetic terms for both. So now it's going to be chi dagger alpha dot sigma alpha dot alpha d mu chi alpha plus chi dagger alpha dot sigma bar alpha dot alpha d mu psi alpha plus, and now I can write a different kind of mass term. So now this is a Dirac mass term. And that term is totally fine, because now when we try to perform the same transformation, instead of adding, the charges are just going to cancel each other. So if we choose the gauge charges of two different kinds of left-handed fermions, then everything's fine. So we chose chi and psi both be left-handed. So there's nothing special about choosing left-handed. The same argument would apply if you chose right-handed fields, which is why we can just stick to using the convention of left-handed fields throughout. And we'll do that when we talk about the standard model. These are both left-handed, and now that we've got a Dirac mass, using two-component language isn't very efficient anymore. So now we can just define, at the risk of using very confusing notation, I'm going to have capital Psi with a D to be a Dirac spinner. This is not a conjugation symbol. This is just the capital part of the spinner. I'm going to define that to be Psi alpha chi dagger alpha dot. So I had to have two different kinds of left-handed spinners with equal and opposite charges so that I could write down a gauge invariant mass term. But now I want to create one object in four-component language. That one object has to contain both things that have the same gauge charges so that I have to conjugate one of them. So now this thing has charge Q psi, and this thing has charge Q psi, which is minus Q chi, because there's a dagger. So I've conjugated it, and that meant taking all of its quantum numbers into their minuses. And in this language, I can consider the following object. So if I have define capital psi bar to be capital Psi dagger times gamma 0, where this is the usual Dirac gamma matrix. So this is 1, 2 by 2, and 1, 2 by 2, and 0. Then we can write down a kinetic term that looks more familiar. Just like that, and then a mass term that looks very similar. Okay, so hopefully it's clear that this and this have the bars, whereas these are merely capital size. And that actually contains all the same information as this right here, where we recall that psi is really this object. The only thing that's potentially ambiguous, I guess I'm going to have to do some erasure. Well, I've already erased that. Okay, so So the only subtlety is that if I take L Dirac and I write it as D slash Psi Dirac, you'll note that this funny conjugation business that also involves the gamma zero is only necessary to take something that contains spinners in this organization and allows the mass term to look like this. But really, in two-component language, we don't have to worry about funny notation. It's always just contracting two spinners that are either left-handed or right-handed. The subtle thing is just the kinetic term, so that after we define psi d to be little psi alpha chi dagger alpha dot, I can think of this, because I'm taking the, so this is chi dagger gamma zero. After I've conjugated this, now I'm going to write it as a rho spinner. So psi alpha dagger, and it'll be chi alpha, where I've just, this is just psi Dirac dagger. Gamma zero is this, so this is gamma zero. For the covariant derivative piece, I'm going to start with, sigma mu alpha alpha dot, and sigma bar mu alpha dot alpha zero. There's going to be a covariant derivative acting on psi alpha chi dagger alpha dot. And now we expand this out. So when I act with this matrix, it just flips these. So it's going to give me chi alpha psi dagger alpha dot times zero sigma mu d mu with the lowered indices, the dotted one on the right, sigma bar mu d mu raised indices acting on psi alpha chi dagger alpha dot. And the kinetic term is going to look very similar to what we saw earlier. The part that involves the bar is going to be the part for chi. So it's going to be chi dagger chi alpha, where this was the alpha dot alpha. So this is the same as before. We had the bar. But for psi, it's going to look just a little different. It's going to look like psi sigma mu alpha 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 dot del mu acting on the daggered version of this. It's going to be, I should have put this up here. Okay, good. But we can integrate this by parts to get it into this form. So really, this is going to be equal to I psi bar alpha dot sigma mu del mu alpha dot alpha psi alpha dot alpha, okay, plus boundary term that integrates to zero, because this is all secretly living inside of an action and we're integrating over d4x throughout. So I guess this is a pretty good place to stop, mainly because I'm out of time. But I promise tomorrow's lecture is going to be more interesting. This is just the necessary machinery to talk about two-component spinners, because a lot of the textbooks in the literature try to do everything in four-component language. And when you do it in four-component language, but the standard model is naturally a theory that involves two-component spinners, where the things that we'll later identify as the left-handed and the right-handed parts of the usual Dirac spinners started life with having completely different charges under big chunks of the standard model gauge group. And so to start with something that forces you to make both parts very similar and then project things out and then use funny conjugation conventions, it seems kind of unintuitive. All the textbooks love to use four-component language and then do this projection business. Srednicki is one example where it doesn't, so I like the Srednicki textbook. But of course, the literature is very, very focused on the two-component language. So you got to know it. So I guess that's it.